Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, and welcome to the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Carla Long, and today I'm super duper excited about our topic. I'm not normally a history person by any stretch of the imagination. Sorry, Mark, but
I'll forgive you, Carla.
Thank you, Mark. But this topic is super cool. I really hope you're going to enjoy it. We're going to be talking all about Jason W. Briggs. And quite frankly, there would be no Community of Christ without Jason W. Briggs. And I don't know if Mark agrees with me on that or not, but we'll find out. So Mark, welcome. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a Independence, Missouri hometown boy, born and raised. I've spent all my life here, except for 4 years at Graceland. It was called Graceland College back in the class of 1972. Now that dates
me. Wow. Go Yellow Jackets.
That's right. I don't know if you can see.
Nice. Graceland University.
I just happened to have that on. So I took a degree in history from Graceland and had a double major. I always wanted to teach because my teaching goes way back in my family. So it just seemed like the thing to do. And so I landed a teaching position in Independence Public Schools, and I taught there for 23 years.
Wow.
What is interesting about it is I had, coming through my classes, people like Laura Smith and Julie Smith and Jeff McMurray and Shelley Spencer. I mean, all these people that are familiar, they're part of our church leadership. I have all the kids in class. And so I struck out some wonderful relationships. And then in 1993, late 93, I got a phone call from the World Church asking, because the outgoing historian, Richard Howard, was retiring, they were looking for someone to replace him, and somehow or another I got the nod and started in September of 94 and stayed with the in the position until May of 2016 when I retired. So I taught for the seminary, Graceland Seminary, taught church history, and became an associate professor of history in the history department at Graceland because of that. I no longer occupy that position. But life has been good. It really has. I was able to publish the three volumes. And at that point, I figured my contribution had come to an end. So anyway.
Oh, and they are such good volumes. And it's called Journey of a People, volume 1, 2, and 3. And it is just an excellent history of Community of Christ if you're interested in it. Volume 1 is from the beginnings to 1844. Volume 2 is from 1844 to 1960-ish.
Yes, actually 1946.
And then the final volume is from 46 on, or to right. Now.
Right.
And it's just an excellent, excellent. So if you're interested in that, you should definitely read them. so let's jump into our main character for tonight, Jason W. Briggs. Maybe people don't even know who Briggs is. They might only think he's a building on the Graceland University campus.
Right. That's a different Briggs.
It is. It's not named for Jason W. Briggs.
Yeah, that's a Gerald N. Briggs, which I know you. I don't know that he had any relationship to Jason W. Briggs. But hey, look at it this way. As one person said, well, if it didn't happen that way, it should have. So
that's right. Because I always thought that Briggs was Jason W. Briggs after I learned who, I just never looked it up. I was a math major. I didn't go to Briggs all that often, to be perfectly honest. Anyway.
I spent many a day in Briggs Hall. So I don't.
Oh, yeah. I bet you did. Well, let's jump into it. So who is Jason W. Briggs and why the heck should I care about him?
Oh, well, yeah, yeah. Okay. So just a little bit of background about Jason W. Briggs. First of all, we don't know a whole lot about his early life, but his contribution is absolutely enormous, as you've already intimated. He was born in Pompey, New York, in 1821, and his family moved, became familiar with the church, the Joseph Smith Jr. He was baptized in 1841, and by a man by the name of William O. Clark, an elder, and Briggs became was ordained an elder in 1843, the very next year, and pursued the missionary responsibility as best that he could. He went in 1844 to Nauvoo to meet Joseph Smith Jr., because he was anxious to meet the prophet, and was there just a very brief time, came back to Wisconsin just before the assassination at Carthage, and then went into this kind of introspection as to what he should do. He joined with Brigham Young just briefly for a year, then left the movement of Brigham Young in 1846, aligned himself with a man by the name of James Jesse Strang. And but that didn't last very long, because Strang announced that he was going to institute polygamy, which was the very reason that Briggs had left Brigham Young. So out of the Strang movement, then he came across William Smith. Now, William Smith was a younger brother of the prophet Joseph Smith. And William had launched his own movement in Palestine, Illinois. In October of 1851, Briggs went to Palestine, met with William Smith, and then learned, lo and behold, sure enough, William Smith was instituting polygamy as well. So forget that. And that's what really threw him into a spiritual tailspin. Because he had tried all these different movements and all these different charismatic followers or leaders, and nothing worked. And so it caused him to do, I think, what a lot of people were struggling with at the time, not just Jason W. Briggs. You know, how do you fulfill your commitment to the movement that you've dedicated your life to? Well, he did essentially what Joseph Smith Jr. did. He had his own epiphany. The irony is, where Joseph Smith Jr. had his in a grove, well, Jason W. Briggs had his out in a farm field, and had a wonderful epiphany that said that all is not lost. I'm not going to try to read it here. I'll just summarize. All is not lost. He asked specifically about William Smith, and the Spirit told him that William Smith did have the royal bloodline. No, I didn't say that way. He did have the seed of Joseph was the actual expression, and that was the key. But he had squandered it like Esau that had squandered the same. And so that eventually, at the end of the really long experience, he was told that Joseph Smith III would be the person with the seed of Joseph, who would eventually arise to lead the movement, and for him to expect that to happen. Well, my gosh, this was on November 18th of 1851, and guys, Joseph III is not even 20 years old yet. And about the last thing Joseph Smith III is wanting is to follow in his father's footsteps, because he, my gosh, the last time he saw his father, he was, I don't say this, well, he was toes up in the back of a wagon. I guess that's a kind of a terrible thing. So actually, he saw his father. They had prepared his body for burial, and that's when Joseph III saw his father last. And it was in the north room of the mansion house. And oh my gosh, he was, what, 11 years old? And there's no way in the world he was going to lead a religious movement, because he feared what happened to his father would also happen to him. So that Jason W. Briggs has this epiphany about Joseph III, and Joseph III is still a very old teenager, that just didn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, that took a lot of, let's put it, it took a lot of faith. And so Jason W. Briggs. Now, have I explained that?
Yeah, you're doing great. So, yeah. So this is an important guy in church history for sure. So that is, yes, November 1851. The organization didn't officially start till April 6th, 1860. So that's right, almost 9 years, yes, between, yes, this original Prairie Vision. It was called the Prairie Vision or something?
Correct. That's
and
correct.
And the founding of the reorganization. So what happened, yes, in those 9 years that, oh, A, turned Joseph Smith III around? And there's another guy in there, Zenas Gurley, that's going to be coming out pretty,
right,
soon too, right?
That's right. Yeah. Jason W. Briggs settled near Beloit, Wisconsin, and at least a good solid horseback ride all day long to a place called Yellowstone, Wisconsin, was a man by the name of Zenas H. Gurley, Sr. Well, Gurley was going through the same struggle, and he was the pastor of a congregation there, like Briggs was the pastor of the congregation in Beloit. They didn't have any contact with each other, and Briggs had his own type of Prairie Vision experience. And it went something like, I, the Lord, say this now, that the son of the successor of Joseph Smith Jr. is Joseph Smith. And he had the same type of understanding when he left that experience. And actually, it was Briggs who sent out the word that, hey, you know, it's going to be Joseph Smith III. And some of his missionaries printed literature, and they ended up in Yellowstone. Well, here's Zenas Gurley saying, hey, wait, time out. I've had the same experience. And so they got, the two got together, June 12th and 13th of 1852, they came together in a conference and decided to launch this movement, which would be called, not the reorganization, not yet, they called it the new organization. And the intent was never to launch a new church. And that it was never to launch it. It was to restore the original church without the problems, without the heresies, so to speak. And that way they would be called the true church. But every Tom, Dick, and Charles Blanchard Thompson is laying the same claim that they are the true church. So it's kind of, will the real true church please stand up type thing. and about 10 people stand up. But anyway, the new organization would be this small group in southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois, and that provided the nucleus for what will eventually be called the Reorganized Church. Now, between 1852 and 1860, oh my gosh, they're having a dozen conferences, two conferences a year, and they're sending out literature. Jason W. Briggs wrote one of the most important pieces of literature himself, encouraging those who are wondering like they are to please come and join. And it was a missionary tract, and the numbers began to grow. And eventually, numerous people started joining in, very important leaders started joining in this movement, including friends of Joseph Smith III and Emma Hale Smith. And that lent a lot of credibility to this new organization. And 1853, Joseph III had a dream that caused him to really start thinking seriously about taking the place of his father. Still hadn't made the decision yet. But then living in Nauvoo, all these people kept sauntering through, heading out to Salt Lake City, asking Joseph to come with him. And he, as a matter of fact, Brigham Young sent missionaries into Nauvoo to try to convince Joseph III, because anybody who had any of the movements who had the seed of Joseph, that would be quite a coup. And of course, Joseph III was so vehemently opposed to polygamy, it was never going to end up going out to Salt Lake or going to Beaver Island, Michigan with James J. Strang, or Palestine, Illinois. He was just not going to join any movement. And what's even more important is that Joseph III said he would have to have an epiphany of his own before he would even consider it. Well, he did have that between 1853 and 1859. He had an epiphany. He married, I should tell you, that in 1856 he married a nice woman, good Methodist woman in Nauvoo, and they had several children. This was before his decision to join with the move. But the point being, he had to have that experience. And when he did, he wrote to William Marx, who had affiliated with this new organization. Now, William Marx was very important, because William Marx and Jason W. Briggs and Zenas Gurley and William W. Blair and Israel Rogers, they all had joined in this new organization. And you're known by the friends that you keep. And William and Rosanna Marx were very close friends to Joseph and Emma Smith. And when William Marx joined this new organization, that meant that there's something to this organization. So between in that 9 years, Joseph Smith III went from just a near 20-year-old to a 27-year-old, and at that point he took the prophetic mantle, as it said.
Yeah. So, like, it seems like there's just some steps that were taken in those 9 years, like really small steps, because Joseph Smith III needed those small steps.
Yes.
In order to say yes. So when did Briggs and Gurley finally approach Joseph Smith III?
Okay, good point. Briggs and Gurley personally did not. When Joseph III wrote, by this time the church was organized in Plano, Illinois. That was kind of the church capital. And that's where the Marx family. And so he addressed the letter to William Marks in Plano. And everybody had for years had prayed that Joseph III would take the prophetic mantle. And it's interesting about Jason W. Briggs. He more or less, Carla, he more or less disappears from the scene. Yeah, he really did. And I'll raise this point later on. But neither Briggs nor Gurley, it was William Marks, Israel Rogers, and there was a third one, W.W. Blair, all approached Joseph III in Nauvoo and said, "Hey, look, oh man, this is incredible." They said, "Okay, now look, Joseph III, we're here to invite you, based upon your letter, we're in to invite you to take this movement as prophet president. However, there's qualification. If you're going to run this church like your old man, so to speak, Iron Fist, he lays the law down, said, it is not going to work. We want, as William Mark said, we want none of you." That was the way he said it. And it was pretty impressive in that they did not want a church president, seed or no seed, that was going to be dictatorial, as they perceived. And that was okay with Joseph III, too, by the way. He had no qualms about that at all, because that was never his leadership style anyway. But anyway, so he, Joseph III, and Emma went to a place called Amboy, Illinois, because they're holding a conference there. And he accepted the prophetic mantle. And that was how Joseph III became prophet president. Now, where does Jason W. Briggs figure in all this? Well, in 1853, in those very early years, they asked, one of the conferences said, "Okay, Jason Briggs, you be our prophet president." And Brick said, "No way! I'm not of the seed." He said, "As a compromise, rather than say no, I'll be president pro tempore, that is, temporary president, until Joseph III takes his place." Well, the missionaries from the new organization were already going out spreading the word that Joseph Smith III was going to be president of the church. And Joseph III had no intention whatsoever of doing this. As a matter of fact, it was one very impressive missionary journey of two important missionaries from the new organization, one William W. Blair, and the other one was a man by the name of Edmund C. Briggs, who happened to be the younger brother of Jason W. Briggs. So they went across southern Iowa, and their testimony was, yes, Joseph III will be the church president, so come and join us. Well, Joseph Smith III had no intention. I know what they're talking about. But nevertheless, they had full confidence, full faith that he would. And by the time they got back from winter quarters, which is where they were supposed to go. And then by the time they got back from winter quarters back to Plano, Illinois, then Joseph Smith III had decided. So, it's really quite a faith journey that.
Oh, it totally is a faith journey. I mean, saying that it was going to happen and probably never doubting it for a second, you know?
Yeah, that's right. And people were being baptized on the assumption that, yeah, Joseph Smith III is going. I don't know what would have happened had Joseph Smith said, "Forget you guys. There's no way." Now, I should tell you that, remember that dream I told you about in 1853? An angel came to him in this dream, showing him two futures. And he said, okay, here's one future that you will be a very well-to-do lawyer in a large city. That's one. Or you will take your father's place. Well, that were the two choices. And then he woke up from this this dream, as it were. And but that's in 1853. He's still got seven more years to go before he's even close to being convinced that this is what he wants to do.
Yeah. So yeah. So what happens with Jason W. Briggs? I know he's a great missionary for Joseph Smith III, but yeah, let's keep talking about Jason Briggs.
Yeah. Okay. So Jason W. Briggs and the new organization was made was ordained an apostle, and it turned out to be one of the most effective missionary voices in the early reorganization. He was eventually president of Council 12. He was kind of the, he was younger than Zenas Gurley by some 20 years, but nevertheless, when Gurley died in 1871, Jason W. Briggs was the other, of course, than Joseph Smith III. Jason Briggs was a very, very influential minister for the church. He was really, really was.
Well, I also, and this might be jumping the gun, and if it is, just let me know, but I know that Jason Briggs came out to Salt Lake City. And
yes, he did. He sure did.
So I don't know if it's too fast to talk about that, but no, it's not.
It's perfect. Okay, so in November of 1874, the church commissioned him to go to Salt Lake City to try to share the gospel, and he did so, and he was there for 3 years, and he launched a newspaper that was very, very influential. It's called The Messenger, and it was so cool because in the opening issue, he said, okay, here's my purpose. Here's the purpose of The Messenger, and here's my purpose, because there was a rumor that there was a missionary from Joseph III out circulating around in the valley. Well, so he says, okay, so here's my mission. I am here only for those who, if you are a captive of the brethren, I think that was the term that he used, which is fine. I expect nothing from you, except to be left alone. You don't have to read the newspaper. You don't have to listen to my sermons. You don't have to do anything. Just leave me alone. However, if you are a thinking church member, then the messenger and the message is for you.
That is brutal.
Yeah. That was just the way he presented it too. That's right. In the very first issue, in November of 1874, and he began to publish issues all the way until February of 1877.
I didn't know he was here for 3 years. That's a long time.
Yeah. It really is. And that is how the church in Salt Lake area had its start, but it was of marginal success, obviously, for obvious reasons. But Jason W. Briggs never lost his zeal. He never lost his willingness to share. By February of 1877, he wrote in his memoirs that he had pounded enough pulpits that when his resources were gone, so it was time for him to go home. And so that ended his tour.
Well, I feel like I'm standing on the shoulders of giants being the pastor of the Salt Lake City congregation now. This makes me feel pretty fantastic. I wonder what Jason W. Briggs would say if he knew I was the pastor
of the Salt Lake City. He'd probably high-five you the whole way.
I love hearing that. I love that.
Well, particularly when you know something about his train of thought, his background, because this really leads to why he left the church. Okay? Are you ready for this?
I hope so. Let's see.
Okay. Okay. So he used the messenger to really lay out his own viewpoint. He was very critical of polygamy, needless to say. He was critical of blood atonement. He was critical of the preexistence. And he laid out all the arguments, scriptures, you know, and his sermons and so on. He distributed literature up and down the streets of Salt Lake City. And he had a very forward thinking. As a matter of fact, he also said, now get this, that the Bible is not literal nor inerrant.
Yes, I was just going to bring that up if you hadn't. I'm looking at this stuff, some of the stuff that Jason W. Briggs wrote, and a couple of the things he wrote, it's like that the Jewish history contained in the Bible was not as a whole written by inspiration, that it was not written by any whose names are a guarantee of its truthfulness as a whole. It was not in the main written by actors in the events recorded or by any who were contemporaneous with them. Like, this is big stuff. This is mind blowing to people now sometimes.
Yes, yes, yes. And you see, he could say these things when he's 800 miles away from the rest of the church. And so he was very forward thinking, and he didn't believe in the creation story, and he knew that Joseph Smith Jr., who supposedly had written the Joseph Smith translation, this was one of his big hang-ups, because it was interpreted back home as the perfected King James Version by Joseph Smith Jr. Well, Jason Briggs said, "No way! There's no way that a human being can perfect anything in that regard, but certainly the Bible." And for example, Joseph Smith Jr. wrote that the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, was written by Moses. Well, that had been discounted for years, for decades, and Jason Briggs knew that, and that here's Joseph Smith writing it. There's no way. I mean, it was just totally discounted. Here's the second one: that Adam wrote the creation story. Well, no. Jason Briggs knew that couldn't be the case. So, but he didn't have any hesitation at all in writing it in the messenger. However, when he got back to Plano, dun 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 dun. Okay, so he asked. So he had some conversations with church leaders, saying, "Hey, look, here's what I've written. Would you give me permission to write it in the Saints Herald so I can lay out my arguments in the Saints Herald?" Well, the church back in the Midwest was very conservative. And for this forward-thinking, even if he's an apostle, a forward-thinking apostle to come back and start spewing these liberal thoughts, that just wasn't going to fly. Now, privately, Joseph III went along a lot with Jason Briggs. For example, Joseph Smith III probably embraced Darwinism. that had come out in November of 1859. Well, if you embrace Darwinism, you can't embrace the original creation story, right? I mean, ne'er the twain shall meet. And so, things like that, Joseph III was pretty sharp on. But if Joseph III, it was never his style, if Joseph III were to slam his fist on the table and say, okay, this is exactly what the church is going to believe, by golly, case closed. That was, first of all, that's his old man style, not his style. And secondly, it would have created tremendous discord. And that was not something that Joseph Smith III was going to allow. So there was only really one viewpoint that Joseph Smith and Jason Briggs really had it out on, and that was polygamy, and Joseph Smith Jr.'s polygamy. Now you remember that Jason Briggs had visited Nauvoo after July of 1843. And rumors were rampant about polygamy and the tippy toeing that was going on in the mansion house was all part of the rumors, and the story. So that so Briggs was convinced that Joseph Smith was a polygamist. What's more, while he is out in Salt Lake City, everybody knows that Joseph Smith. So it wasn't a big secret for Jason W. Briggs until he gets back to the Midwest. And that's when he told Joseph III, hey, listen, you're old man. Listen, he had all kinds of wives. Well, no, Joseph III would never accept that. Eventually, it led... When Joseph III refused to allow Jason Briggs, he was editor. Joseph III was editor of the Saints Herald. When he refused to print Jason W. Briggs' viewpoints, they started doing this. And by 1886, they had parted ways. So there is a direct connection between the Salt Lake of Jason W. Briggs and the Midwest of Jason W. Briggs. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. That is really interesting. So Salt Lake was the beginning of his demise. I hope that's not true for me, since I live out here, too.
it's all your fault, Carla.
Gosh, I hope not. I was thinking about Joseph Smith III, and I'm sure you know more about it than I do, but he came out here, too. I remember...
Who's that?
Joseph Smith III came out to Salt
Lake.
Yes,
that's right. He made portraits.
And I remember hearing a story, and I might be wrong, but he was preaching at Fort Union, or he was preaching at a church. I think it was like a Fort Union area in Salt Lake. And they paraded all of Joseph Smith Jr.'s wives and put them in the front row so that he would see them. He probably had so much cognitive dissonance when it came to his father and the polygamy, and no one knows why he said what he said or why Emma Hale Smith said what she said on her deathbed.
Yeah.
But it had to be just such a hard situation for both of them.
To be sure. As a matter of fact, in one of his trips out there, he wanted to meet his cousin, John Smith. Now, this would have been on Hiram's side of the family. So he's a cousin. And John Smith, they were good. It was a cordial relationship. wasn't harsh or anything like that. As a matter of fact, John Smith invited Joseph III over for supper. I mean, it was a very cordial thing to do. And so gave him the address, and Joseph Smith knocked on the door, and a woman opened the door and invited Joseph Smith in and into the living room. And John Smith came out from a back room, and they gave a big handshakes and so on. He says, "Oh, they said, Joseph, this is my wife. Okay. And so, so they're talking around a little bit more, and they go over into another room, and a second woman comes out. Okay. So John Smith said, Joseph, this is my wife. Okay. So this is my wife, and this is my wife. And so they're sitting down for supper, and the third wife came out with food. And John Smith said, Joseph, this is my wife. Can you get the voice inflection? So, and that was really the very first encounter Joseph Smith III had with polygamy. That was his very first encounter. Yeah.
I'm sure it struck a chord because he wrote about it, I'm sure. And that's how you now know the story.
That story is in his memoirs, incidentally.
Oh, it's just mind blowing.
Yeah.
Utah is mind blowing in a lot of ways when it comes to polygamy, anyway. I've run into a lot of polygamists out here, and it never ceases to amaze me.
Well, I must admit, Carla, during my 20 years as church historian, some of my closest friends, I say this sincerely, some of my closest friends were LDS Mormon. As a matter of fact, my counterpart with the LDS Church was a man by the name of Snow. And he and I really struck it off. As a matter of fact, when he would come to Independence, he would stay here with me. And there were times I would go out there to Salt Lake and I would stay with him. And the only one problem that we had, he always beat me in golf. Doggone it. I was so frustrated. No, I'm just kidding. We were golfing buddies. So we had a grand time.
Love hearing that. That's awesome. Yeah, I really love hearing that. Yeah, were you ever in the archives over here?
Oh, yeah. Spent lots of time. As a matter of fact, he was the director of the Church History Museum and the archives and the library and so on. And one of my cherished moments was in Ogden. He invited me to come out, and I gave a lecture there at the archives. And then he took me to down to Provo, and I gave a lecture there. Then they were going to dedicate the Ogden Temple. Well, you know, in the opening days, people can walk through it. So we got a VIP tour, and when we were coming out, we were coming down the sidewalk, and Marlon Jensen. Now, you probably don't know who Marlon Jensen was, but he was Elder Snow's predecessor, and he and I had a close relationship together. So, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. So we got together and had a nice chat, and Elder Jensen's wife took a photograph, and I have that photo, framed it, and I put a brass plaque on it, and I made a copy for Elder Snow and one for Elder Jensen, and I have it, and it's just one of my it's one of my cherished possessions.
It's pretty amazing to go through one of their temples. I've been through a couple myself. Even that experience right there is weighty. And then to have that happen is really, really cool, Mark. Thanks for sharing that story.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel like we could talk all night. So is there anything else on Jason W. Briggs that we should talk about? I know he also talked about inspiration and prophecy and being a prophet.
Yes.
And I don't know how much you know about this. I only know because I have part of his quote in front of me right now, but his view of a prophet and prophecy is very similar to what we would probably say today. And
exactly.
Do you want to talk about that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It became one of the problems. But that he posed to the church in the Midwest, because he believed that there is a veil of humanity that separates the divine from the human. And even in Revelation, there is something lost when the message transmits through that veil, so that you're thinking that you're getting the literal inerrant word of God, when reality is no. A revelation is experience. It's not literally, should not be literally taken. Well, if 3/4 of the church comes from the Nauvoo period or the Kirtland period, and they've gone through Joseph Smith Jr., you know, thus saith the Lord, speaking under the influence, and so on, for an apostle to communicate, no, that's not the way revelation takes place. It's an experience that you have to grow with and understand. You can understand why then it created problems for the church. Yeah, it really did.
Well, for sure. I mean, I don't know how I should say this, but without like kind of the modern thinking that we have now, and also mm-hmm. stating clearly that we are non-literalistic when it comes to the Bible. Like, that's yes. a pretty huge statement for any church to make, and nowadays even. I mean, that, I feel like that idea of prophecy kind of comes with that territory, you know? Yeah. I mean, yeah. there's no way it couldn't come with that territory, I don't think.
Right. So it's a, you know, he was so far ahead, he was light years ahead of the church at the time. And now, he left the church in 1886, okay? Well, in 1893, there was a lawsuit. Remember the Temple Lot case? Over who owned the actual plot of land?
Right.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah, for our listeners, if you don't know, you know, like where our Community Christ Temple is on the corner of River and Walnut, we own catty corner from each other. We own, Community Christ owns the auditorium, and we own our temple, which is that big spiral building, if you've ever seen pictures of it, listeners. And then on the other two catty corners, the LDS Church owns the, what's it called?
The Visitor Center.
Visitor Center. And then there's this lot that is just like basically a big thing of green grass with the Hedrickites, or the Church of Christ. Right.
Granville Hedrick, yes. And so Joseph III brought suit to lay claim to that little plot of land right across from, beautifully centered between the stone church and the auditorium, right? And just as an aside, the architects laid it out so that the center of the auditorium goes exactly with the center of the stone church. And secondly, the little Hedrickite church is not much more than a house. You know, you've seen it. It's not more than a clapboard house. So the stone church had to be a beautiful stone edifice that would dwarf, obviously. But anyway, go back to the lawsuit. A lot of the church leaders at the time were deposed for this lawsuit. It was a district court lawsuit, including Jason W. Briggs, and he was grilled pretty hard because of his. Remember the Council of 12, he was one of the founding fathers of the movement and so on. You would expect for him to know a lot. So he was grilled pretty hard. Well, when he was asked about his membership in the church, he admitted that he had left the church. Well, the lawyers, that raised their eyebrows. Well, why, sir, did you leave the church? Well, he could have said about polygamy, about the refusal to accept polygamy or to acknowledge that Joseph, or he could have talked about this idea of revelation, you know, he had, or he could have talked about the literal inerrancy issue, disagreements that he had. He never mentioned anything like that. He said the reason he left was because he was not allowed to lay his arguments out in the Saints Herald. And that was his justification. So that was pretty interesting, really. But that was Jason. There's so many mysteries about Jason W. Briggs. Just, I don't know if you want to get into this, but he's a very mysterious person. Were you aware of some of the things about him? For example, just to mention a couple of things. Okay, so he's one of the, he and Gurley are the two founders, right? Okay, he's president of Council of 12, right? Right, okay. President pro tempore of the church, right? Okay, the most effective missionary voice of the church, right? He's got all these credentials, but he was not invited to go to Nauvoo to meet with Joseph III. Strange, isn't it? Well, it gets even more strange. When it came time to ordain Joseph III, who's standing there to place their hands on Joseph III's head? Well, it's Zenas Gurley, it's W.W. Blair, it's William Marks, and it's Apostle Samuel Powers. So the question is kind of a where's Waldo? So it's kind of a where's Jason type of thing. There are other occasions where you would expect Jason W. Briggs to be there, but he's simply not. And I have yet, you know, I never did figure out why he was not at the founding of the reorganization, the very church that he helped to launch. It just doesn't. As a historian, those kinds of things, I don't know, they gnaw on me, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, like a non-historian like myself would never even think to ask that question, or maybe I would if I knew as much as you do, but I probably never will. But it's so, that is really interesting to wonder. I mean, you know, sometimes I wonder if that maybe he had a little bit of a grating personality. Like if he was that forthcoming when it came to, you know, what he wrote in the Messenger, maybe he was hard to be around.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the great writers. He wrote that appeal in 1862, which was one of the pivotal pieces of literature of its time. So it's not like he disappeared. Maybe that's what he just wasn't there. Now I don't know why. I wish there was some logical reason. Maybe there's some kind of document in somebody's attic. I don't know. That will answer that question someday.
You never know. Well, Mark, thank you so much. This has been so interesting, and I just really enjoyed it. I'm shocked by how much I've enjoyed it. No offense, historians.
That's all right.
But thank you so much for telling us about this incredibly important figure in our history. This is very, yes. Very exciting.
Yeah. Well, my best to all the viewers, and I look forward to, you know, answering email questions or something, you know. You've got my email address, Carla. If you feel so great, then go for it. But anyway, I wish you all the very best, and congratulations on the Project Zion. I've logged in on numerous of them. So.
Oh, I'm so glad you like it. We have a lot of fun doing it. So thank you for your support, and thank you again for being on the interview with me.
Okay, very good. Good luck to you all.
Bye, Mark. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.